From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Hold Me Accountable. The US Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is grilled at a House hearing on the troubled rollout of the government's healthcare website.
I am as frustrated and angry as anyone with the flawed launch of healthcare.gov. So let me say directly to these Americans, you deserve better. I apologize.
We head to Tunisia, where the popular tourist destination has suffered its first suicide terror attack for over a decade. We take a look at the alarming trend that means the majority of public school kids in America's South and West are now considered low income. And we hear from South Africa, where footage of the brutal murder of a schoolboy is challenging the country's media ethics.
Concerns and questions being raised here is that essentially what you are doing is you are airing a snuff movie, if you will.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama's health secretary has been forced to apologize to the American people over the bungled rollout of his administration's health care reforms. Grilled by U.S. lawmakers, Kathleen Sebelius has vowed to fix the ongoing problems with the government-run health insurance websites, which were supposed to register 7 million uninsured Americans in the first year. From Washington, Nina Maria Potts reports.
So let me say directly to these Americans, you deserve better. I apologize.
An apology from America's health chief direct to the American people over the messy rollout of what was meant to be one of President Barack Obama's main legacies, healthcare reform. Kathleen Sebelius said sorry, then denied that the main vehicle for insuring the uninsured, the federal and state-run insurance websites, had crashed. She said they were slow, but the problems would be fixed. In a testy exchange with U.S. lawmakers, she declined to provide data on how many Americans had tried to enroll.
I don't want to turn over anything that is not confirmed and reliable, and that's what we'll do.
Well, but that data out there exists. And
sir,
I would tell you right now,
it is not reliable data.
Kathleen Sebelius did say the buck stopped with her and that the American people deserved better. But polls show the public is still deeply frustrated with and confused by Obamacare. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
A delegation of German intelligence officials are in Washington today in regard to allegations the U.S. spied on German Chancellor Angela Merkel's private phone calls for over a decade. While U.S. President Obama has denied the allegations, leaked reports indicate that actual National Security Agency activities over many years have not aligned with the president's stance. However, U.S. spy chiefs have defended the intelligence programs, saying that their work saves lives around the world. According to the latest statistics, Spain has come out of recession for the first time in 2 years. The country's GDP increased 0.1% in the third quarter, confirming estimates released by the Bank of Spain last week. Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman has the latest.
Well, that 0.1% climb in GDP last July has come as very good news for Spain, a country that's finally overcome 2 years of deep economic recession and recently seen an export boom as well. Though analysts are warning against celebrating too soon, the country still has a long way to go to bring down that sky-high level of unemployment. The rate is now above 26%, and it's among the worst in the Eurozone. Economic growth, of course, will help to create more jobs, along with Prime Minister Rajoy's labor market reforms. But meanwhile, the worrying aspect is that Spain is seeing some of its top talent spill out of the country in search of jobs elsewhere.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. New charges have been brought in Russia against prominent opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin critic, already convicted of embezzlement, is now charged with money laundering. Ollie Barrett reports from Moscow.
Alexei Navalny and his brother are accused of defrauding two companies out of around $1 million and of money laundering to the tune of $650,000 more. The charges carry a maximum 10-year prison sentence, but Alexei Navalny describes them as nonsense. The latest indictment comes only days after a court suspended a 5-year prison sentence given to him in July for embezzlement. The conviction was upheld, though, meaning Navalny is barred from running for public office. Navalny says the new charges are a warning from Russian authorities to anyone who steps out of line, he's always claimed the investigations into his affairs are politically motivated. Ollie Barrett, Moscow.
And a group of British newspapers and magazines are trying to get an injunction to stop a charter on new press regulation being passed. They are arguing that the publishing industry has not been consulted sufficiently. Natalie Feary has more from London.
The group of newspapers and magazines had proposed their own charter, which they are arguing has not been given proper consideration. Publishers are worried that the new charter that has been agreed by politicians would hinder press freedom. The charter was proposed following the hacking of phones by journalists and the subsequent Leveson inquiry into press ethics. A spokesperson for the Department of Culture, Media and Sport said the charter had been considered fairly and included changes to deal with press concerns. Natalie Feary, London.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. At a House hearing today on the troubled rollout of the Affordable Care Act, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius personally apologised for the problems millions of Americans have had in purchasing insurance plans on the newly set up federal exchanges. Sebelius assured committee members that many experts are working on the website healthcare.gov, which she expects to be much improved by the end of November. But Republican lawmakers weren't soothed and continue to demand the now three-year-old healthcare reform law be delayed or repealed. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
At Wednesday's hearing, Republican members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee aggressively questioned Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, often raising their voices, interrupting her, rolling their eyes, and speaking sarcastically.
I don't want to give misinformation.
I want you to go home and research it. If you're wrong, will you go into the exchanges?
If
you can, will you?
At one point, frustrated, Sebelius replied, "Whatever," to a member's intense line of questioning. But she also apologized to the American people for the problems with the healthcare reform law's implementation, saying they deserve better.
I apologize. I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems, and I'm committed to earning your confidence back by fixing the site. We're working day and night, and we'll continue until it's fixed.
Sebelius said she expects the website, which was down during most of the three-hour hearing, to be much improved by November 30th. She reminded the lawmakers and reporters present that the open enrollment period lasts until the end of March and said the public has, quote, plenty of time to sign up. But many Republican lawmakers, joined by a very small handful of Democrats, think the nation needs more time. On Monday, they introduced the Delay Until Fully Functional Act, which would postpone the individual mandate until 6 months after the Government Accountability Office certifies that the website is fully functional. Since signing up as many people as possible as quickly as possible is crucial to the long-term success of the system, the Obama administration does not support this delay. Though their voices were not represented at the hearing, many on the political left also have major concerns with the Affordable Care Act, especially the fact that an estimated 30 million people will remain uninsured. Most of those people live in states that have refused to accept federal dollars and expand Medicaid, and their income is so low that they can't afford even the cheapest plan on the new insurance exchanges. Secretary Sebelius said at Wednesday's hearing that these people will qualify for a hardship exemption from the fine charged to people who don't buy insurance, but there is currently no plan to make sure they have care.
And this is really just unacceptable. We are the United States is the only wealthy country in the world that has a privatized healthcare system. It makes no sense.
That's Ann Larson, an organizer with Strike Debt, a group that raises money to help bail people out of debt and advocates for progressive social policies like single-payer health care. The group has focused mainly on helping people across the country with unmanageable medical debt.
So we've heard from many, many people, and the stories are horrific. You know, people whose lives have been ruined, who have been harassed for years by debt collectors, who lost their homes. Once you get sick, when you can't keep up the bills, you're going to lose your house. You're not going to be able to send your children to college. I mean, these things have a domino effect. The stories that we're hearing from across the country are really terrible. And we don't think that forcing people to purchase private insurance is the answer.
The Affordable Care Act is expected to cover tens of millions of people who are currently uninsured, but the affordability of the premiums with those new plans hinges on whether the government can convince millions of people, especially young and healthy ones, to enroll. Secretary Sebelius promised to provide numbers of how many have already enrolled when she returns to testify before Congress again in December. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
German intelligence officials are currently in Washington for talks at the White House, following claims that U.S. security agencies listened to the communications of thousands of European citizens and monitored Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone. Mrs. Merkel's foreign policy advisor and Germany's intelligence coordinator are among those in town, and their visit comes after the European Parliament have already voted in favour of restricting how data is collected in Europe by US firms including Facebook, Yahoo and Google. It's part of what looks like a backlash against American data collection on the continent and could have big commercial implications, as Lorna Shaddick reports.
The German delegation to Washington say their visit this week is about rebuilding trust. Next week, the heads of Germany's foreign and domestic spying agencies will be in town, looking to see how the two countries might be able to work more in harmony in the future. But the visit comes as Barack Obama is struggling to address a wave of anger from foreign politicians. And that anger could have implications beyond the diplomatic realm, potentially hitting commercial activity too. Here's British MEP Claude Moraes.
There is a big commercial sensitivity here. If mass data has been transferred and there is not sufficient justification and encryption systems cannot be trusted, then there is a big commercial deficit. There's also a big trust issue for companies in relation to commercial media. This is not me saying it, this is business leaders who are concerned that the ongoing allegations and lack of answers to those allegations can cause commercial sensitivity.
Those concerns mean some in Europe are now floating proposals that could make it harder for US internet firms to do business on the continent. They could be forced to move their servers to Europe, or the EU could push customers towards locally run competitors instead. Another potentially significant casualty of the latest allegations could be the ongoing negotiations over TTIP, or the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That aims to remove trade barriers and make it easier to buy and sell goods and services between the EU and the US. If it happens, it would be the biggest free trade deal in the world. But the Germans in particular have made it clear that TTIP cannot become a reality until trust has been re-established. MEP Axel Voss explains.
We should continue those negotiations, but Americans, all of us, are well advised that this data protection question is solved before, not within the TTIP negotiation, but solved before. To get that out of the way, we hope really that this situation now will help us.
But Alan Friedman from the Brookings Institution says it's unlikely these revelations will indeed help, since the two sides already had big differences over how they treat personal information, with the US seeing data collection as a way to make money and serve customers, and the Europeans having moral objections to that.
Americans took the position, they said, Europeans are going to have to understand that in the global age they need to get over this quaint notion. And the Europeans, for their part, said, listen, it's in the Americans' interest to have this trade agreement, so they'll have to understand that this is something that we're not going to give up on. So they were talking past each other for quite some time. This is going to make matters worse and certainly make it much harder politically in Europe for negotiators to sort of ignore this and come to some compromise, because domestically they'll face a lot of pushback.
Pushback, indeed, from European businesses, many of whom now feel they cannot trust a partner with whom they're supposed to be formulating ever deeper and closer ties. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
The distressing sound of a teenage student being murdered in South Africa. The nation has reacted with shock and outrage following the release of the video showing pupils savagely attacking and beating the 18-year-old victim. The assault was originally published online by South Africa's tabloid newspaper, The Daily Sun. The nation's broadcasters have so far declined to air the footage. FSN Simon Marks asked editor-in-chief of South Africa's e-news channel, Patrick Conroy, for some background on the story.
There have been a number of high-profile cases of violence in South African schools. Teachers beating up children beating up teachers, children beating up each other. But what happened in this instance is that a tabloid newspaper obtained cell phone, mobile phone footage of a group of pupils beating up and then stabbing to death a fellow learner at the school. This was captured on video. They beat him up. It's about 30 or 40 seconds. And then a longish object like a spear is used. He is stabbed. And he is then left on the ground to die. He was rushed to hospital, but he died in hospital. And the storm that has erupted now around the story is that many news media outlets have run this entire video on their news websites.
So this video, as it currently stands, has only been carried online. It hasn't been screened by the nation's broadcasters.
No, it hasn't been. It hasn't been aired on television at all. It has been run by the tabloid newspaper on their website. It's been run by a very prominent radio station, 702, on their web service. And the kind of ethical concerns and questions being raised here is that essentially what you are doing is you are airing a snuff movie, if you will. You are showing video of an 18-year-old youth being murdered. We believe that the six or seven boys who are seen beating him up and stabbing him may be minors themselves. And the question is, what's the right of the child? What's the right of the victim in this instance? And really, are these news organizations simply putting this video on their website to drive traffic?
Now, you at E! News Channel, and we should disclose to listeners that Feature Story News has a business relationship with E! News Channel. We provide material to E! News Channel from our bureaus around the world. You have taken the view that you are not going to carry this video on your website, but other very prominent broadcasters, certainly on in the commercial sector in South Africa, have taken a different view. What kind of debate have you been having with other editors and journalists there today?
Well, there's been two arguments put forward by those who have published this online. And the first one is that, well, it's out there, it's in the public domain. And our problem with that is that just because everyone else is committing a crime or is behaving unethically, we don't feel that that we should follow suit. But that's not a justifiable defense. The second argument being put forward is that in an online space, the user opts in to see the video, that there's a warning that precedes the video, and that you would then make a conscious decision as an individual that you would watch it. It's not forced upon you. And that may be satisfactory to some people. For ourselves, it is not. But what's extra disturbing in instances like this is that in the case of Eyewitness News, the 702 radio station, they have pre-roll advertising before you see the murder. And while that might not be illegal, it is certainly, in our view, a very unethical move on their part, and would suggest that there's more of a commercial motive behind publishing this content than there is one of public interest and really looking at the problem of violence in schools.
But Patrick, do you reject the argument that there is an editorial value to showing this video, horrific though it may be, in that it does bear witness to the kind of violence that unfortunately is being seen in some South African educational institutions?
In this case, you know, we have had videos in the past of school ground violence, and I think the issue is well documented. It's foremost in our minds. It is something that gets a regular media attention. My concern is that I don't know that showing the murder of an 18-year-old youth at the hands of children, really, who could be younger than that, adds any value to the debate and the problems at hand. By all means, tell the story. By all means, highlight the problem. But I'm not sure that actually airing the murder of an innocent 18-year-old does anything to actually help us solve the problem of violence in our schools in South Africa.
And finally, does there need to be a bigger conversation in South Africa about editorial standards and guidelines, particularly with regard to the use of video in the online space?
Absolutely. I think that what we have seen in the past is news organizations airing this kind of footage merely to drive traffic to their website and not to actually have a proper look at the issues at hand and to do proper journalism. And I think what we've got is people who have been guilty of substandard journalism in the past now trying to defend this on the basis that this needs to be seen, that we can only understand the problem if we see the murder. And I don't buy that at all, because I think it's well documented, it's well known what the problems are in this country. You have to be living under a rock not to understand that there's a problem of violence in our schools. This video isn't going to do anything to shed any more light on the matter.
Patrick Conroy, Editor-in-Chief of South Africa's E-News Channel. A majority of students in public schools throughout the American South and West are now considered low income, according to a new study. The analysis by the Southern Education Foundation is based on the number of students from preschool through 12th grade eligible for the Federal Free School Meals Program. Earlier, I spoke with Michael A. Rebell, Executive Director of the Campaign for Educational Equity at Columbia University, and began by asking him how he explains this statistic.
Well, it's an alarming trend, and what this latest report showed is that the increase in the number of high-poverty children that we had known has occurred very much in the West, has now spread to the South. Or more specifically, this pattern affects the whole country and socioeconomic trends in this country. The other factor is that more upper-income children are departing the public schools. So this is a very frightening trend because of the key role that public education has always played in our nation's democracy and our nation's economy. And it's a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call to really focus on improving the schools and improving the public schools that that doesn't mean continuing the trends of emphasis on private education and escapes from public schools. Public schools have been the bedrock of the country, and their quality is not improving to keep up with global pressures and global challenges, and that's what needs to be done.
And in socioeconomic terms, how are these children and these families being defined as low income?
I think it's somewhere around $40,000 a year for a family of four, which in today's economy doesn't get you too far. But what it's reflected in school is it's children who come from academically deprived backgrounds who tend to need extra support. So it means that to bring these children up to the level that our federal policy and most state policies emphasize, namely that all children should be able to graduate meeting challenging state educational standards, that becomes more and more of a challenge as the gap between rising standards and the standards are related to what we need to prepare children to be capable citizens in the 21st century and to compete in the global marketplace. Those standards are rising, but the readiness for learning, the readiness for school with which children enter kindergarten is declining because of the weakening of our social safety net and cognitive and other reinforcement that parents can give children at an early age when they're themselves struggling to barely make ends meet.
What do you think, in the short term perhaps, policymakers, politicians, educators can do now to try and arrest this statistic?
The immediate kind of thing that can be done is to bolster early childhood education and pre-kindergarten so that some of the gap in learning that occurs early on for kids from these low-income backgrounds can be ameliorated. And to overcome that, you've got to get these kids into educational environments, early learning programs, pre-kindergarten. They become very important. You've got to hone up their language, too, so they're in a position to reinforce their kids, to understand what's going on in school, to read to them, to understand the importance of literacy. So all of these things are really critical.
Michael A. Rebell, Executive Director of the Campaign for Educational Equity at Columbia University. A suicide bomber killed himself in the Tunisian tourist resort of Sousse on Wednesday. No one else was injured by the explosion. Police say they have detained another would-be suicide bomber in a seaside town, Monastir. It was the first suspected Islamist terror attack in the country for over a decade. FSN's Nina Maria Potts spoke to news editor for Tunisia Live, Farah Samti, who gave us the latest.
Yes, so this morning a man committed suicide by blowing or bombing himself in front of a hotel in Sousse on the coast of Tunisia. There were no injuries and it was just the man who died.
Now, Tunisia is one of the Muslim world's most secular countries, and it hasn't suffered a suicide attack since 2002. Why has this alleged Islamist assault happened there now?
We still don't know the motives behind the incident yet. The only thing we know, according to the statement of the spokesperson of the Ministry of the Interior, that the suicide bomber is a Salafist, but we don't have any other details about that. Tunisia has witnessed other attacks recently against guardsmen as well on the borders. It seems that it's a new wave of violence, but the motives could be different this time since it's a touristic region.
And do you get a sense that people are worried about it, that this might be a turning point?
Yeah, I mean, there was a small protest that happened today right after the incident where people were protesting against terrorism because, again, it's new to Tunisia. This is the first time it happened since the after the revolution and, like you said, since 2002. So everyone was surprised by the news today.
And how are Tunisian authorities fighting this Islamist threat? How damaging do you think it could prove for the country's tourist industry? I mean, you said that since it's a touristic region, it could be a real live issue.
Yes, I think they're aware of it. And I think just earlier, the Ministry of Tourism announced that there was a unit, a crisis unit that was just formed in order to coordinate with the Ministry of the Interior and to get information about the security situation and make sure that everyone is safe and that if there are any warnings or about any potential violence that they would hear of it. I think there's more security presence now and there were already some arrests made recently and we'll see what happens.
Tunisia Live's Farah Samti. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can email us about the show at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Thursday, the US soldier fighting for the Afghan interpreter who saved his life. That's Thursday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Rebecca Foster. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.